Stay tuned for The Lynn Show. Today, I'm continuing to play interviews I did with directors who are directing productions for the 2012 Oslo Repertory Theatre season. Today's interview is with Greg Lemming, who is not only directing the production of God of Carnage, which is an extraordinary production, but is also the director of the FSU Oslo Conservatory for Actor Training. I interviewed Greg a while back, and I'm going to play the original interview and follow it with an interview that I did recently in which I talked to Greg particularly about himself as a director. So hang on. Here come the show.
Hearing from an inner voice, finding choice where there's no choice, with gentle prodding from the voice. Oh, you really can. Deeper, deeper down. Finding wisdom's other words. Oh, you really can. And it's always there, like a silent hug from no.
Hello, and welcome to The Lynn Show. The Lynn Show is all about discovering, recovering, recapturing, finding, using, having access to all of what we are. To that end, I usually talk about that with examples from my private practice as a psychotherapist, and I do an interview series of people who make their living or their life with an art. Recently, I have been, as I said, in the lead-in to the show, interviewing the directors who are responsible for the production at this season's as Oslo Repertory Theatre. Today's interview is with Greg Lemming, who not only directed one of those shows, God of Carnage, but also is the director for the FSU Oslo Conservatory for Actor Training Company. I interviewed Greg previously, and I am replaying much of that interview, partly because it gives you a sense of Greg, and partly because he talks a little bit about directing, a lot about teaching acting, which you'll hear in the interview, I'm absolutely fascinated by and think you might be too. And it also bears on who Greg is as a director. In addition, he talks about his direction of The Invalid, which he did previously. and I'm going to follow that with the interview I just did with him, which is specifically about Greg as a director, in which he talks about his philosophy of directing, his style of directing, his directing of God of Carnage, and he talks a little bit about The Invalid as well. So I'm not going to say very much more about anything else, except here is Greg Lemming.
I am here with Greg Lemming, who is the director
of the FSU Oslo Conservatory for Actor Training and the associate director of Oslo Repertory Theater.
Wow. It's an interesting organizational
chart. Very complex chart, yes.
What I am mostly interested in is how you came to do this with your life.
Oh, sure. Well, I like everybody involved in the theater, I started out wanting to be an actor, but I was 6 foot six and...
Yeah, you are, my God. He stood up and I'm 5 feet.
And
so is it that there are just not that many roles for people?
I had a boyish face when I was a young kid.
Did.
Well, even more boyish 30 years ago. Mm-hmm. And you don't have that many roles for young men who are 6 foot six. The last show I was cast in professionally was a production of Our Town, and I was playing George next to a 5 foot two Emily. It was really dopey. So I figured that was the point that I decided to find another connection to the theater, and I studied directing. When I got out of graduate school as a director, I worked in New York for a couple of years with a number of organizations, and then was hired as the dramaturg at Hartford Stage Company. So really my professional career has been in the regional theater. I've always worked in regional theater. I've been associate director of theaters, I've been artistic director of theaters, I've bounced around mostly New England. So coming down here was interesting to me because I got to align myself with the Oslo Rep, which is one of the major regional theaters in the country. But the other reason I'm here is because while my passion is working in the theater and directing and producing theater for communities, I've also started in the past 10 years to get very interested in training artists and working with artists to create the foundation for allowing them to have lucrative and long-lasting careers. So I jumped at the chance to combine both impulses. So running a graduate training program was, along with being able to direct and work with producing at the Oslo Rep, was a great thrill, so it was a nice combination.
Yeah, it's the best of all possible worlds.
Yeah, it is.
Right?
It is. I get to be a generalist instead of a specialist, and I like that. I do a lot.
Well, you get to do both,
actually. I do a lot of things instead of only one thing, which I like.
Actually, that's an interesting statement. A lot of people who fall in love with an art wind up doing a lot of things.
Well, sometimes that you have to do it to keep your head above water. I mean,
yeah,
it's really
survive.
About keeping body and soul together. I know almost no one who works in the theater who doesn't have to support themselves with some sort of secondary job like teaching. I was very lucky. For 30 years, I never had to. That's really surprising. I mean, I'm one of those very few people who managed to have a career for a long time and still have managed to hold on to a career in the theater without having to support it with something else. It's not an easy thing to have happen.
Not needing a day gig.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Or having to, you know, get out of one big hit show and then turn around and temp for the next 6 months or that sort of stuff. Teach on the side. It's just, you know.
So how did you fall in love with acting in the first place?
Well, I'm not an actor.
In the beginning, when you wanted to be an actor, do you remember that at all?
I know that I got interested in it because I think everybody who goes into theater feels looks at that as a place where they can actually feel comfortable being center stage. It's an ego issue. It has to do with wanting to express yourself, sort of show yourself off and show yourself off emotionally to the world in a place that's safe for doing that. I think like everyone else who I knew when I was in the theater, when I became interested in the theater in high school, I was always such an odd, geeky kid that it was always a great place for me to feel at home. I think that's how a lot of people get involved.
I'm sure you're right.
Yeah.
Where did you grow up?
Oh, Long Island. Yeah, in fact, when everybody else was stealing their family cars to go out to parties, I was stealing the car to go to New York to see plays. Yeah, so we would sneak
Were you literally?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. I would steal, we would say, I'm just going to a friend's house around the corner, Mom, I'll be back at 11 o'clock, and we'd drive into the city and see a play and come home.
Really?
Yeah, sure.
Okay, so this is really interesting. You come from this family that is not interested in the arts. And so where do you think it came from? What do you think triggered it, turned it on? Do you remember the first time you thought, acting, you know?
I do remember the first production I saw that made me want to go into it. It was a television production. In fact, I worked with Sam Waterston once when I was at Hartford Stage, and I mentioned to him at a rehearsal that I felt like he was the one that made me want to go into the theater, because he was in a production of Much Ado About Nothing that was at the Public Theater in New York in the early 70s. Sam Waterston and, I'm going to forget her name. Oh, my God. I had the two of them paired up forever. But it was in this production of Much Ado About Nothing at the Public, and it was televised in the mid to late 70s. And I just fell in love with this production so much, it was on a couple of times that one weekend. I remember watching it over and over again. And
what play was it?
It was Much Ado About Nothing,
right.
Shakespeare's Much Ado About Nothing.
So you already were familiar with Shakespeare, though. I mean, this was not a... I mean, this is an unusual thing for a boy in high school to find attractive.
Well, I was a reader, and I do remember that this is so geeky, but I used to read Hamlet a lot because it was a great murder mystery to me.
Yeah.
I always felt it was a great, wonderful murder mystery.
Well,
you know,
it is.
My God, did he or did he not do it? That was the great thing about that play to me, and so I used to read that. I remember reading, I was at my uncle's house I must have been 11, 12 or something, and I was down in their den while the family was having dinner, and he had a copy of Death of a Salesman on the end table, and I picked it up and read that for the next 2 hours. For some reason, I just liked reading plays.
It is unusual, though.
Maybe
you haven't ever thought about that, but...
I just liked reading.
Yeah.
I just loved reading.
Right. You like fiction. You like stories.
A lot of fiction.
Really.
Yeah, exactly.
That's it.
Yeah,
you like stories. I understand.
Yeah.
I understand that very well.
Sure.
And, of course, if you like stories, there's writing and acting, essentially.
Yeah.
You know?
Well, I think... I'm not sure I was ever much of an actor, but I know I always liked being involved with telling stories. That thrilled me. Especially telling stories and structuring stories and watching people respond to the stories and not having to be a part of that. I like having that, being in that position as a director, sort of being the editor with a group of actors and sitting down and deciding to tell a story and finding out the tone of the story and the structure of the story. And
It's interesting to me that this is something of a dichotomy, it seems to me. On the one hand, when you first started talking about it, you said that actors are people, and I pretty much assume you were talking about yourself as well, who are looking for a place to express themselves and to allow their emotions to have reign. And
I got over that.
Yes, that's what it sounds like.
You're right.
It sounds like you got over that.
I did.
Yeah, right. And so now, instead of that, you are more interested in creating an environment for other people to do that.
Well, I mean, I'm actually, that's what I love so much about what I do now. I get to do both. I get to create, I get to work as a director and do that with a group of people and tell stories with a group of people. And I get to work with young artists who are interested in exploring the same world and want to investigate the craft from the ground up. Those are two different impulses, and it's really thrilling to be on both sides of them.
Could you talk just a little bit more about them, the ways in which they're different, what it means to you?
Well, I think there's a point at which, I don't want to sound like the old man in the sea, but there's a point at which when you go back to doing something a lot, you start to do it, you develop muscle memory, you develop sort of an intellectual muscle memory, and you do things not by rote, but by sort of unconsciously.
Yes.
And for good or for bad, I mean, sometimes it's not a great thing, sometimes it's what has to happen. And the nice thing about working with young artists is that you actually have to stop and think, okay, what are the first principles that I'm taking care of unconsciously, that I'm not thinking about anymore? What are the first principles that get this process rolling?
You mean for yourself?
For myself or for anyone in the business and it working at it. And so we get to stop and explore those with young directors and young actors. And that's pretty exciting. That's great. I taught high school for a while. I actually liked to teach.
Yeah.
But I taught high school for a while, and I hated that because I was just a traffic cop. And then I taught undergraduate for a while. And sometimes I loved that. But that's actually more about helping people develop psychologically. I think as an undergraduate, you're developing a personality more than you're developing a career.
It's an interesting point. I never heard anybody say that.
I think that's why liberal arts are
so important.
What they are is that it's about people developing a broad personality. And because you're really dealing with social issues and psychological issues and personal issues. And that's also not something I'm terribly interested in getting too deeply involved with. So the nice thing about working on a graduate level is you really focus in on the craft. You're still emotionally involved because in this art form, you sort of have to be. You have to deal with the emotional level. So that's kind of great for me. It's worked out really well.
Yeah, it sounds actually like you've found the thing that works best for you.
So far, yeah. Absolutely.
Now, that's an interesting statement. Is that because you think, well, I'm always evolving and it could be something else some other time?
Well, you know the joke about the psychiatrist studying the pessimist and the optimist, the five-year-old child. The five-year-old pessimist is put in a room full of with horses and spends an hour sitting there sobbing until finally the therapist walks in and says, what's the matter? And the pessimist looks up and says, I knew you were going to take this away sooner or later. The optimist is sitting in a room just full of hay and horse dung and is spending an hour giggling and throwing it up in the air and running around and playing it. And the psychiatrist walks in and the optimist, the five-year-old boy looks and says, I know there's a pony in here somewhere. I'm the pessimist. Sooner or later they're going to take it away from me.
I see. Yeah. I see. Wow.
You know, I'm the person who's going to die and have on his gravestone, I told you I was sick.
Wow. and you've always known that about you.
Oh, I don't know. I guess so. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But I mean, it's also a matter of, I've only been here for 4 years. I still like doing it. I was working in the theater for 25 in regional theaters, just from one theater to the next. And when I sort of reached the point where I knew this is it, I've sort of reached the top that I'm going to, as far as I'm going to go, I needed to jump out of that. So who knows? I mean, I don't think I'm interested in sort of growing, and I'm certainly not interested in growing in the university community here. I don't want to be a dean, or I don't want to be, you know, I'm not interested in that. I may get bored with what I do someday. I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe I'll just finally open that bookstore.
Did you? And yeah. Do you direct?
Mm-hmm. Yes, I do. I direct once a year on the Oslo stage, once a year on the conservatory stage with the graduate students, and then usually during the summer I try to do a show.
So what are you directing this week?
I'm in the middle of working on a production of Imaginary Invalid for the Oslo,
mm-hmm.
which we're having a lot of fun putting together, mm-hmm. which will be opening the Oslo rep season in January. And then with the students, I'm directing a musical, chamber musical, called Three Postcards by Craig Lucas.
Yes.
The man who did Light in the Piazza. And that'll be in April on the historic Oslo stage with the conservatory students. And then, who knows, I'll have somebody to hire me this summer. So it's usually two a year here and then hopefully one out of town.
Okay, so it sounds like you really have found a place that, at least for now, you can throw some straw around and...
Yeah, I can. There are some things I'm really good at as a director, and
What are they?
Comedy. I'm very good at that. I'm very, very good with new plays, with contemporary work, and in some cases, I'm pretty good with Shakespeare and intellectual, sort of cerebral work like Shaw. But there are some things I'm just not good at that I will never grow into that are beyond me. So I'm better off in a place where I can pursue my strengths and explore other things like the administration of this program and the teaching on this program and working with the faculty and working with the students.
Did you ever think of writing?
I've actually done some. When I first got here, when Howard Millman was in his last year, mm-hmm. and he showed me the list of plays that he was doing, and we hadn't talked about which one he wanted me to direct yet, and he showed me the list, and I saw a play on there that had been about 2 years before I got here. I was hired to do an adaptation and translation of a French farce in Dallas, and I had so much fun doing it. In the middle of that French farce, they refer to another French play, and Howard had on his list that French play, and so I jumped up and down and begged him to let me do that. So I've done two translations, adaptations. I've got some other work in a drawer. I've been working on an adaptation of a novel for years, and I'm just I got through Act Two, and I'm just hit a brick wall. Every time I go back through, the brick wall doesn't move, so someday I'll get around to finishing that. That's pretty much it.
Can you tell me the novel?
No. I mean, other people have adapted it. I think I found a way into it. I love the novel, and someday I'll do it. Someday.
I understand that. Do you have anything to say to aspiring actors, to people who are thinking about this career?
Well,
in the theater?
The cliche is, if you can do anything else with your life, do it. That's the cliche. I don't think I believe that now, actually. I mean, now that I think about it, I actually think that if you actually can commit yourself to this fully and commit your life to it, do it. But that's a big if.
Yes.
Because it's not a guaranteed living. It can be a very frustrating lifestyle. You have to be very stable psychologically to do it as a freelancer. I never did it as a freelancer. I'm not stable enough. I was always with a regional theater, with an institution. But as an actor in particular, you know, you're constantly, every single time you end a job, you start from scratch.
Right.
You're always at the whim of somebody else's taste.
Right.
And so it takes a lot to be able to say, I commit to this completely. But I actually think it's a very full life. It's a very, you get to lead, it is really leading an extremely rich, thoughtful and engaged life on all sorts of levels. I mean, I think it's pretty exciting.
It's funny. When I'm listening to you, I'm thinking, it is true. I think it's true. You know, I don't speak for truth, but I think it's true that as an actor, when you're working anyway, it's new. Whatever it is, it's new. And it's challenging, and it's assuming that you really do like what you're doing, that it's exciting, and it's in those ways, if that's something that turns you on, you know, okay. There are a lot of people who are not turned on by, you know, they want the same thing every day. They
yeah.
want to, you know, they don't they want secure.
Sure.
And
sure.
But if you're turned on by this. Mm-hmm. Then you get it in spades.
Oh, absolutely. And it's also very personal. I mean, it's a life led from a completely personal and self, not selfish, but from the self.
Mm-hmm.
You have to engage in everything you come across. You have to personally engage with everything
yes.
so often. I think it's a very vibrant way of living. Sometimes too vibrant, and it can really beat you down psychologically, and it can be tough. But it's a good way to lead a life. It's very exciting. I was just talking to one of our graduates on the phone today, this morning, graduated about 3 years ago, and we always had, he's an old, one of our older students, and we had a very good time working together. And just in passing, we talked about trying to come up with a project to do this summer. And, you know, being able to make those kind of connections, to develop work with people you respond to and to explore material together from a very personal perspective. It's very exciting. That's really
yeah, cool. And it's this making something out of nothing
yeah,
thing.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, it's wonderful.
Mm-hmm.
And if that's something that turns you on, that doesn't turn everybody on.
Yeah.
You
yeah.
know, and I think that's really kind of what you were saying, that if this engages you, attracts you, captures you, right?
Fully.
Fully, right,
yeah,
right, right.
If you're engaged by it fully, then it's what you should do. I think that's actually the better way to look at it than say if there's anything else you can do, do it.
Well, you know why people say that.
Well, because you can't make a living.
Because in our culture, that, you know, the idea of, making a living is...
Well, and also art is frivolous in our culture. It's not something that you have
agree.
To have.
I agree.
Yeah, and if you're an artist, you're pretty much outside the mainstream. You're not really, you are only respected if you have fame as an artist.
You're saying, I interviewed a musician yesterday, and you are saying what I said yesterday.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
You know, it's so clearly the truth.
Yeah,
and
sure.
This is a relatively young guy, he's 32,
right.
And he is completely engaged in it, mm-hmm. and for its own sake, and understands perfectly well that he may never make a living. He'd like to be able to retire someday and have money in the bank, but mm-hmm. that's not, but it doesn't matter because that's not what it's about. And that's what you're talking about, right?
Yeah, I think with, I think as a musician, I wonder if you can say that. It's a, it seems to me that it's a little tiny bit different. I feel like when you're, I don't know, I'm way off base. It was always a choice when I was a kid. It was a choice between music and theater for me. And I've often been sorry I didn't continue with music because I was a French horn player. But there's something about creating music as a group or individually that is exciting to have an audience there, but it's not the purpose in an odd way. It's not as much the purpose. Musical performers may say the exact opposite to me, but it always seems to me that there's something about working as a group with other musicians to produce something for the sake of producing it is a little bit easier than working as an artist, an actor rather, on a...
Well, I think, I mean,
the electricity of the audience is essential to the actor. I guess maybe most musicians would say that electricity for the audience is essential for them, too.
No, I don't think that's true. I think you're right. I think, actually, a musician can get a kick out of playing in their own house by themselves.
Yeah,
I think that's really true, you know.
And I think there's value in the document, I mean, the recording that exists, you know, in the forest and when nobody's there to see it.
Right.
And that is always of value. The way a film is always of value. It exists, it's an artifact. But in live theater, there's no value if somebody's not there to watch it.
No.
It's not the same. It just doesn't exist.
The only caveat to that is actors often, when they're not working, spend a lot of time in class working on stuff.
Well, that's doing your etudes. That's doing your
right,
scales.
Right.
That's keeping your muscles.
Right. But they can get a certain amount of pleasure from that.
Some, but it's a means to an end. It's not the end.
Yes, that's
That's
right.
not the end.
No, that's right.
Yeah.
That's
like
right.
If a flautist can do scales over and over again, but if you're not playing part of a concerto, then what's the point? It's not as interesting as the concerto.
Yeah, I saw a documentary once on, I do not remember her name, a female conductor, symphony conductor, and she was saying, you know, a musician can play in their house, an actor can actually work in, you know, can work, but a conductor needs an orchestra.
Yeah.
And
sure.
She, you know, that's
well,
just...
Well, that's sort of the same thing with the director.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yes, that's right.
Mm-hmm.
A director needs a...
You can prepare a production all you want, but until you get in the room with the actors and the audience...
So you can speak to this, the difference between acting and directing and teaching
uh-huh.
for you.
I don't know. I think teaching, I'm beginning to realize, is Socratic. The right word. It's about making people come to realize, forcing people to come to discoveries about what they can and can't do.
As How do direct, you do that?
Well, I think one of our faculty members here is particularly good at it. I tend to talk too much in the classroom, but he doesn't answer questions. Somebody asks a question, he makes them do another exercise. Somebody asks a question, he makes them do another exercise. And it's frustrating to the students, but suddenly, I think by the end of the year, I think they suddenly realize, oh my God, I discovered this for myself.
You know, it's not only Socratic, but it's a little Zen, isn't it?
Yeah, a little bit, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
As a director, I think you are aware of the road you want to travel, and you're trying to engage everyone with you to travel that road together. You're not quite sure what the speed is. You want to make discoveries along the road. But you're also, you hopefully will be firing up the energies of everybody else in the room so that while they're getting on your road, they're also making discoveries and making little gems for themselves.
You know, I really think, this had not occurred to me before, but I don't think I've ever talked to anybody about this, that in the way you describe it, I don't think all teachers would have this one, but I think in the way you describe it, the one is about helping the other discover themselves, the teaching. But the directing is about telling them what to do, essentially.
Well, not really, though. That's what I'm trying to hedge. It's really not telling people what to do. If you're just telling them what to do, then the actors are just marionettes. It's about, as a director, you have to figure out what the path of the play is, but then invite other people on board to bring their portrait of the journey along with them. You can't tell them how to experience the journey. Their experience of the journey has to be as...
This is really interesting because I hear what you're saying, but in the end, you get to say, don't you?
Well, as a director, you're not an autocrat, you're an editor. You have to engage people's imagination, and then when they bring something in the room, you actually have to edit for them. I think directors are less of an artist than they are a technician. I really believe that. I think a director is really a technician. You learn how to read a play. You learn how to view other people's work and help them edit it. You learn how to sort of light the fire under people.
And then you stand back and let it flare.
Stand back and let it happen, and then you step in and edit a little bit more and edit a little bit more. That's what a real director does.
I believe you, but I would be willing to bet that not all directors have that perspective.
Maybe not. I don't know. It's possible. It's possible.
So in that way, teaching and directing is not that dissimilar.
You know, it's actually not. That's true. Although, as a teacher, you are very aware of the skills you want people to become aware of. You just can't.
Make them.
You can lead them to water.
Mm-hmm. Can you mention a skill?
Actually, one of the things that I'm doing, working on with the actors I work on every year is, one of the skills is being able to read a text objectively and to evaluate a script for what it is giving you, not for what you want it to give you. It's a really difficult challenge. A lot of actors and directors really have absolutely no idea how to read a play.
Can you say more about that?
Well, they will read a play lightly and then decide exactly what it's saying based upon their own perspective. They're really being very subjective. I had a student, this is sort of a perfect example, but 5 years ago I had a student when I was teaching undergraduates, and we were working on Glass Menagerie in a directing class, and he just hated Amanda Wingfield. And what I kept saying to him was, does Tennessee Williams want you to hate Amanda Wingfield? Show me in the play. And we did this over and over again. So finally, finally in one session, he just burst out, yeah, she's just like my mother, and I hated my mother. And the thing is that what he's bringing to the work is a subjective response rather than reading the work to figure out exactly what the playwright is trying to get at. And that's a real challenge. I mean, it's very hard for, we teach literary criticism. We don't teach dramatic criticism.
This is fascinating.
It's a completely different technique.
It's fascinating because I imagine that it's very difficult to do what you're suggesting.
It's very hard. And a lot of students get very frustrated with it and hate me for a couple of months. And then I think usually by the end of the year they sort of, they may not get it now, but I think in a couple of years down the line they often get it.
Well, the problem is that in order to do that, you have to have self-awareness.
Yeah, you have to be aware of how you're responding. You have to have a dual conscience.
You have to know yourself. Know thyself.
You have to watch yourself respond to the play and then go back and figure out what in the play made you respond that way. And all that has to happen before you can even decide how you're going to interpret the play. And that's a big challenge.
That's really, and boy, I wouldn't have come up with that ever as a skill to teach an actor. I mean, I would just never have thought of that.
Yeah.
Do you want to give us another one? I mean, I thought you were going to talk about things like sense memory and...
Well, you know, the other thing is an actor's imagination has to be vibrant and available, and you have to have a huge resource, well of emotional and imaginative resources. But you also have to know how to communicate that and bring that up and engage an audience in that. And that is a peculiarly theatrical sensibility. And figuring out what that element of theatricality is pretty tough. I remember the first school I was taught at full time. The other faculty hated anything that what they referred to as theatrical. They hated it. It wasn't real. Well, you know what? Standing on a stage with 500
right.
people watching it was
yeah,
not real.
Right.
It's not real.
Right.
And nobody thinks it's real. But there's that funny little,
yes,
we have a compact. You know, I will never let down my guard and show you that this isn't me up on stage. And you will respond to it as if it's really happening. It's going to be safe for both of us, but we will allow the danger of the situation to exist and take us right to the edge. That's what the compact is in the theater.
Do you want to say that one more time?
Well, I mean, the actor is never going to let his guard down and let the audience believe that this is an actor acting.
Right.
The audience is going to always keep themselves open as much as possible to everything that's happening on stage.
Everybody is buying the...
You are buying it to a certain extent. You're always, however, aware of the fact that it is a performance.
Right.
It's what Aristotle said about Greek theater, is that, you know, what makes it theater is that element of an entire community getting together to watch a reenactment, not to watch the real thing.
Right.
There's nothing thrilling about watching a car wreck. There is something very thrilling about watching a reenactment of a car wreck. And because you're aware of it not
being quite real.
Right. It might be very offensive to a lot of people, but I just went, you know, I was raised a Catholic, and I went back to a funeral not long ago, and it was a funeral mass. And I forgot how stylized and ritualized the whole mass is, and how, you know, so many Christian fundamentalists talk about it as fact, when actually it is a reenactment. It's a mythological event.
It's a performance.
Much more, it's much with a lot of poetic overtones. If it were real, it's not as interesting. Poetry has far more depth and scope than prose. And these are poetic events. And they can mean more if they're poetic. A metaphor has a lot more weight than a fact.
Wow.
It has a lot more, it covers a lot more ground.
Do you know why?
Do I know why? I guess because it's about... A metaphor engages the human imagination.
Yeah, see, I think it speaks to the unconscious.
I think you're right. I think you're absolutely right. It engages, mm-hmm. it engages
right,
a lot
a much
more.
Deeper level.
Yeah, a much deeper level,
mm-hmm.
sure.
Right.
And that's what I think...
It bypasses the conscious mind.
Right, sure.
right.
And the theatrical process, I think, is all about that.
Yeah, right? I think you're right. I think you're right.
So getting an actor to be able to have that duality of depth and truth and honesty and... pair it with the expression, the exhibitionist tendencies that all actors have to have. Being able to compare those two and balance them out is a real challenge.
It's a real challenge. Boy, I'm so glad to be having this conversation with you.
I
imagine that this is a kind of a mini course in what it means to be an actor, and I would guess that pretty much anybody who is not an actor doesn't know this stuff. Doesn't know what it's taking to do that
sure,
well.
Sure, I mean, you know, and I'm sure, you know, there's nothing more annoying than walking, you know, when you tell somebody working in the theater and somebody's been working in insurance for the past 65 years says, oh, I've always wanted to be an actor. Yeah, well, I've always wanted to be an insurance man, but nobody would hire me to do it because I don't have the skills.
Yeah, right.
You know,
right.
I always wanted to be a doctor, but I'm not committing brain surgery.
Yeah, right.
Exactly.
You know, it's a complete disconnect
mm-hmm.
of what it takes to do that thing.
Sure.
And, so I'm going to say again that I really appreciate, it's clear that you have thought this through, and whether you've thought this through or not, you're really articulate about it.
Tomorrow.
Yeah, right. No, but it's really articulate, and I really do think it's something I haven't come across.
Great.
I mean, I haven't, you know, nobody has said the kinds of things you're saying, and that's a value to me, and I imagine it's a value of the people who's value to the people who are listening.
Great.
So, is there anything that you think I haven't asked you or that you might like to say about anything?
I don't think so. No.
Good.
Who knows, I've talked enough.
Probably not, but I appreciate it. Thank you very much.
My pleasure. Sure, absolutely.
And of course I was right. He had not talked nearly enough. And now we're going to hear more talk from Greg Lemming, this time, as I said, specifically about his directing chops. And so hear more from Greg Lemming.
I'm doing this series on all of the directors who are directing for this season.
Uh-huh.
And and I'm asking them to talk about their philosophy of directing, to talk about directing itself. If you have a philosophy of directing or an idea about what's important about being a director or what's important to you about being a director.
Well, the thing that's very important to me is it's always been about the text. My job is to interpret the text. I don't really think of directing as being an art form. I really think directing is a technical craft in which you apply a variety of disciplines to interpreting the text as objectively as possible and finding ways to communicate the text to an audience. So it really does start, for me it starts with the text. But the variety of disciplines that you use range from massaging the set design in terms of set costumes, lights and sound, visual in terms of movement and shape.
Hold on a second.
And then rhythm.
So essentially then you're saying, what I'm hearing anyway, is that in terms of the physical, the set, you have to know a lot about set design, about sound, about light.
No, I work with a set designer, and I work with a sound designer, and I work with a lighting designer, and my job is to focus those designers in on my, what I assume to be an objective interpretation analysis of the text. I mean, I have to bring myself to the text, and I'm going to find in the text the things that interest me based upon my psychology. But that said, I think my job is to be as objective in analyzing that text as possible and bringing out what I feel the playwright's primary interests are.
You know, I remember you saying that as a teacher, one of the things that you're looking for is to help the actors separate out their own interpretation from what the playwright is trying to. I remember that very clearly.
Uh-huh.
And so essentially you're saying the same thing now from the director's point of view.
Well, that's what a director does. And then when working with actors, the actor will bring his or her personality to bear in the room and their own interpretation of the text. So the job as a director with an actor is twofold. One is to help make sure the actor is remaining true to the script and identifying the key components of the script that are going to make that character sing and live. But then it's also my job to edit. The actor brings into the room a variety of ideas, and my job as a director is to edit those ideas. That one works, that one doesn't. Let's run with this idea, let's not run with that idea. And then to find a way to fold the variety of ideas that are brought into the room by the variety of actors into a single whole.
Yeah, okay. Do you mind trying to be specific for me? I mean, I know that for you, when you say interpret the text, that has a very specific meaning for you, but it doesn't for me. So in terms of the set, can you just give an example of what you might say to a lighting or a sound or a set designer?
Well, working with the set designer for God of Carnage, Judy and I have worked together a lot, and one of the things that we talked about was it takes place in a living room, but the playwright specifically says nothing too naturalistic. So
what does that mean?
It means nothing too real.
Ah.
So our job is to figure out what she means by that, what that has to do with the action of the text. And as we worked on the play together, we talked about how the play it essentially devolves into a boxing match between four people. And it's four people who are responding viscerally with violence. So one of the things that Judy tried to do was to find the sort of rigidity of a boxing ring and then bring into that specific elements of a living room, but also surround that with non-specific elements that could then be manipulated by the lighting designer as the play went on so that the sort of heat of the evening could be manipulated by the lighting designer by the way he focused his lights on those back walls. And the back walls were specifically meant to be outsized, monolithic. The designs on them were created so that you could shine light on them and alter the way the texture was seen And those are the decisions that a designer makes. Those are the decisions that a designer makes based upon discussion with the director and the other designers. When we did Imaginary Invalid, one of the things that we had to deal with was what we were trying to do was create a world that allowed for very specific entrances and exits, i.e., there had to be three doors and one window. We wanted to play with a kind of French formal environment, but we also wanted to give it as much contemporary sort of cartoon flair as possible. So she played with perspective. She played with right angles and made sure that there were no right angles on the set. So those are the decisions that a set designer will make to help out what the director is asking for.
Okay, and I'm assuming that these things influence the audience psychologically, that they're subtly. Right,
so
that's the word I wanted, was right, right. And play to making the point that the director believes is the correct interpretation of the text.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Okay.
And actually, it's not, I don't think it's a matter of making a very specific, concrete point, as in, an audience shouldn't leave the play saying, oh, I see what the point of this evening is X. But you try to create an emotional response in an audience so that the audience experiences the event in a specific way and leaves the evening having experienced the event according to the way in which the playwright seems to want the audience to experience the event.
Wow. Okay, great. So, and in terms of techniques, I mean, you were talking earlier about directing. That was really interesting to me, as what I assumed you were saying is a skill which mm-hmm. essentially can be learned.
Mm-hmm.
And that there were a number of different kinds of techniques that a director could bring to directing. Is there anything in particular you like to use or find?
Well, it's just about the techniques of physical movement in the space, making sure that it's an issue of focus so that when anything is said on stage, you need to be aware of what you want in focus for the audience, which means shaping the physical positions on stage so that the audience's eye is drawn to a certain direction when you want it drawn to a certain direction and pulled away from a certain direction when you want it pulled away from that direction. Like this silly little, there's a big physical moment in God of Carnage. One of the actresses has to get hooked up to a machine on stage that the audience can't see, but what we want to do is pull the audience's awareness away from that place where she's getting hooked up and pull their focus elsewhere. That's a sort of simplistic example of your job is to also manipulate where the audience is looking at any given time.
Like a magician.
It's very much like a magician. Mm-hmm. But it's also about geometric shapes. People at the top of a triangle will be in focus. Individuals at the bottom of a triangle will not be in focus. One of the challenges with God of Carnage is that the actors, because it's a very naturalistic event, a sort of realistic event, they really just wanted to experience it and see where it took them. But frankly, what that means is they didn't want to be blocked, in other words. But frankly, four people on stage, you have to block
it. Oh, my
them.
God, I'm thinking, one of the things I wanted to ask you about mm-hmm. God of Carnage, and I do want to talk about it specifically, mm-hmm. Was what a nightmare blocking that must have been.
It was hard. But it was, the actors... The whole process was the actors try something, and then you edit it, and then you fix it and say, all right, it's not throwing the right people into focus, so let's adjust it here and there.
Right, there are too many of you over there.
And then you get them to adjust it, and you get them to hold on to the blocking.
Really? It's wonderful. It was terrific. Congratulations.
Thank you.
I mean, you must be really delighted about it.
Yeah, it worked out really well. We're really proud of it, yeah.
God, it was wonderful.
Mm-hmm.
And I will say, and I'm saying, go and see it.
Mm-hmm.
It's amazing. But even while it was going on and I was completely captured by it, I was thinking, good grief, how do they keep from tripping on each other and getting in each other's way?
Well, it's also, I know it drove the actors crazy, but the set designer and I also wanted a very small space.
Yes, it's so compact,
space, so
there's so much stuff in it.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
But they do manage somehow to get where they're supposed to go and do what they're supposed to do without mm-hmm. hurting each other and themselves.
Absolutely.
Yeah, and I'm I'm pretty sure you would agree, you had some pretty spectacular actors on that stage.
They did a great job. They did a beautiful job.
Yeah. Oh, my God. They were perfect. Yeah. I thought they were perfect.
Yeah, yeah.
So is there anything you want to say about the play itself, about...
No, it speaks for itself. I mean, it's great. the play is what the play is, and it's, you know, the it's a very exciting sort of 70 minutes in the theater, and it's great watching.
Yes, it goes
go,
by yeah, like that.
Yeah, it really does. But it feels like you've just gone through Virginia Woolf, and that's
yes,
fun. That's
it does. Mm-hmm. It does.
Mm-hmm.
Can you talk? This is not actually about directing so much as about playwriting, and maybe you're not the right person to ask this, but. The end.
Mm-hmm.
Can you say a little bit about why you think she ended it that way?
We found in the rehearsal room that it really was the last moment is the four characters suddenly realizing how far they'd gone,
right,
and realizing just how destructive they've been, and frankly. At the end of the play, being absolutely alone.
Each one,
very alone.
In there.
Be completely lost in you know, relationships are pretty much gone. And I think that's where the play ends. And you don't necessarily see that on the page. I think you actually have to discover that in the rehearsal room. That's something we just...
And you see it on the stage.
Yeah.
You absolutely see it on the
mm-hmm.
stage. It's interesting to me that, I mean, they're all alone... But it's Kate, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, right. To her daughter.
Mm-hmm.
I thought that was an interesting place to put her. You know, mm-hmm. I mean. Okay. So, anything that might be interesting to us about having put God of Carnage on the stage? Anything that we haven't already said?
No, I know. I think it's. God of Carnage is about the most accessible thing I've done in a long time. It just really does speak for itself, I think.
No doors, no going in and out of doors.
I remember. Everybody's sort of stuck on stage,
right.
And they can't leave. I mean, the challenge of God of Carnage is to create a situation in which two characters can't leave the stage.
Right. Mm-hmm. Did you want to do this?
Yeah. 2 years ago, Eva Slain brought us this. It hadn't even opened in New York yet. It was in London, and she saw it on one of her trips to London and brought me the script, and I read it, and I loved it, and I brought it to Michael. We decided we needed to do it, and we tried to get the rights right away, and then it opened in New York.
Mm-hmm. That's happening a lot here.
Yeah, and what's interesting is that by the time we got into the rehearsal room on the first day of rehearsal, there had been a lot of attention on the play around the country, but we had committed to it about a year and a half ago. So we committed to it very early.
Well, it's extraordinary. Mm-hmm. You did an amazing job, and congratulations.
Oh, great. Thanks.
You're welcome.
So there you have Greg Lemming's take on directing. If you were listening 2 weeks ago, you heard Mark Rucker, who directed Once in a Lifetime, which is so delightful, so enjoyable, so just a pleasure for a night in the theater. And Mark's take on directing is different from Greg's. And next week, I'm going to interview Clyde Compton, who's assistant to the director of Yentl, which also just opened at the Oslo. And Clyde's take on directing is slightly different. And hopefully, I'm going to have at least two, maybe three more directors talk to you about their take on directing. And then, when you see the plays, which I hope you will come to see, all of them, you can have this information in your head. Will you know more about directing? Will you see more in the performances, in the shows, because you know something about what the director was thinking, trying to achieve, aiming for? I certainly hope that you will. So now let me say, I was going to play Sharon Leslie's wonderful review of God of Carnage, but I don't have enough time. So let me just tell you that Sharon says what I say. It is amazing. It's an amazing piece of theater. Not only Greg's directing, but the actors, oh my God. So hopefully you will get a chance to see that, and you will have in the back of your head some of the things that Greg has said about what he had in mind for it. If you are listening to the show, and you liked it and you want to hear more of my interviews, you can go up on my website, thelynnshow.com. That's thelynnshow. Don't leave the E out of Lynn, Lynne, The Lynn Show, because you'll get another Lynn. You can download the podcasts to your computer. If you click on download, there's a whole list of ways in which you can download it. You can download it to iTunes, from iTunes to your iSomething. You can download it to a Droid. You can listen to it right on your computer. That's if you want to hear any of the interviews. And there are about 200 of them now. You can also learn about my book, When You Can, You Will. You can read the article that I've written on phone therapy in case you're interested in phone therapy. If you would like, I would love it if you would click on email me, tell me where you're listening. Also, if you have any questions about phone therapy or about me, and if you want or need someone to help you with computer recording electronics, then as I say every week, you need Josh Hackney. And you can get him by going up on my website and clicking on email me and say, get me Josh, and of course I will. As always, I hope you heard something in this show that you can use. As you can have heard, I heard a lot of things that I found extremely useful and extremely interesting in both the first interview that I did with Greg and then on the one he did on directing. I'm sorry that I didn't wait to see God of Carnage before I heard this, but the play is fascinating, even if you haven't heard all of the inside stuff from Greg. So I hope that you've heard something that you can use, that you were interested in, that will bring you back, because, as always, I will be here next week, same time, same station, and as always, I hope you will be too.
You see, I'm getting older, my hair is turning gray. Oh, you say my face and figure have both seen better days. Well, I won't be retiring, I won't slip out of sight. No, I will not go gentle into that good night. I won't go with a whimper, I am going with a bang. Life's a song I keep on singing, not a tune that I once sang. I just keep returning like some goddamn boomerang. No, I won't go with a whimper, I am going with a bang. You see that I have had my shot, my time has come and gone. Oh, won't I please get off the stage, let someone else get on. Well, I won't be relegated or leave without a fight. No, I will not go gentle into that good night. I won't go with a whimper, I am going with a bang. Life's a bell I keep on ringing, not a chime that I once rang. You may think it's unseemly, well, I don't give a dang. No, I won't go with a whimper, I am going with a bang. Rising from the ashes, every chance I get. I may be running out of time, but it ain't over yet. 'Cause me and Sister Phoenix, we won't give up the flight. No, no, we will not go gentle into that good night. And I won't go with a whimper, I'm going with a bang. Life's a song I keep keep on singing, not a tune that I once sang. I may not be as juicy, hell, but I still got some tang. So you won't hear me simper. I may have got the